When the public listens to experts talk, there is an air of respect that pervades. We admire the confidence, the lofty language, the grasp of the topic so eloquently explained. But underneath, there is another thought that is far too embarrassing for most people to admit. They haven't understood a single word. Now, often experts write things and you become comfortable being an expert. It's written in a language. But no one ever writes what happens when it doesn't work.
Welcome to the Major League Eventing Podcast, the show for eventing fans by eventing fans.
And Karen, as usual, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Mane & Tail, Karen.
Only the best.
Only the best. We love Mane & Tail. You know, we always talk about all the different horse products that Mane & Tail puts out, but you know what? They do have a full line of beauty products for you and me, Karen.
They sure do.
So, do you have a favorite product that you'd like to use for Mane & Tail?
I think I would have to say it's the hair strengthener.
The hair strengthener. Definitely seen that on your beauty counter.
I love using it. I tell you what, it really has strengthened my hair. I have less split ends, and it's actually, I get a little thin in certain areas, and it's actually been growing.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love your hair, but I know you've always had, I know you've always complained about, you know, your hair being a little thin, and you're always picking at your split ends and all that stuff. So, and I see you using this, and I do see an improvement. So let's hear all about it, Karen.
So it is a daily protective and fortifying leave-in treatment for stronger, healthier hair. It nourishes and repairs. It provides essential protection to help prevent split ends. Protects hair strands from heat and chemical styling, which I do a lot. I do a lot of that. Provides additional moisturizing and conditioning protection. It is alcohol-free, and it's safe and gentle for all hair types.
That's wonderful. So, like I said, I know you've been using it and you love it. And we asked the folks over at Mane & Tail, hey, can we talk about the beauty products because they are so fantastic? So, because the audience, the horses aren't listening, Karen.
No, they're not.
You know what I mean? It's the people. So, I use the products, you use the products. So, we're going to start, you know, mixing in some of the beauty products along with the horse care line. So, check it out at maneandtail.com if you want to learn more about the products. And we just got to say thanks again to Mane & Tail for all their support over the years. Triple Crown Feed.
Oh, yeah.
Triple Crown. Big fans of Triple Crown Feed. They have tons of great products out there.
Mm-hmm.
Premium stuff. Karen, what do you got to say over there?
So Triple Crown has formulas that are tailored to your horse's unique needs and help support immunity and gut health. Find your local Triple Crown Feed dealer by going to triplecrownfeed.com.
Triplecrownfeed.com. That's a little bit of a tongue twister.
Triplecrownfeed.com.
They have a great feed locator. They have a great feed comparison tool on their website. I encourage everyone to get over there. Check out Triple Crown Feed's website. Check out the different products. Check out what makes them so special. And give them a shot, right, Karen?
Oh, yeah.
Support the people to support the show. The Rain Turtle by Turtleneck, the best rain sheet on the market, Karen.
The best. It comes in a 1, 2, and a 3 piece with a 3-year waterproof warranty. And it has a full antibacterial lining.
Yeah, fantastic. Of course, they have the stretch panels. So, Karen, if people want to learn more, learn about the Rain Turtle, the sizing, how to measure your horse up for sizing, how do people learn more and purchase the Rain Turtle by Turtleneck?
Just go to turtleneck.biz.
Trish Scott's got us covered, and she can cover you. Trish is on with us to talk about equine mortality and medical coverages, which is a lot of changes, Trish. So tell us, what's going on in the industry right now, and how can you help people?
Yeah, there's a lot of changes going on in the equine mortality medical coverage right now, and I just wanted to put the word out there that we don't have to be afraid. Changes are coming, but I can certainly take care of, you know, whatever questions, concerns, you know, our vendors have. Right now, the biggest one is Great American is not offering any medical coverage to any renewals or new business. And the thing is with our Venters, they're one of the top three rated horses for mortality. So it's a very unique breed of animal, very unique training. So we need to make sure that your policy is covered. I have access to some of the top rated carriers right now. They are all offering full mortality, medical, surgical, any coverage is needed for our Venters. Don't worry about it. Just give me a call. I'll be more than happy to walk through your current policy and make sure that your renewal is covering your horse. Not a problem. Just give me a call. I'm always available. 484-319-8923.
I recently treated myself to a pair of the Fairfax and Favor Boudica ankle boot. And they come in several different colors, but I got the black leather. And they have a shearling lining, so they keep your feet nice and warm during these cold winter months. Now, I've read all over social media about how comfortable these boots are, so I decided to test them out. The first time I wore them, I took our little Stanley for a very long walk, and it was several hours later when I realized I never took these boots off. That is how comfortable they are, and I've been wearing them pretty much every single day. And I wear them to work, and I wear them around the house. So to get yourself a pair, check them out by going to fairfaxandfavor.com.
I'm Robbie.
And I'm Karen. And we are your hosts of the Major League Eventing Podcast. And Robbie, I'm excited about this guest.
Me too.
I've been, growing up, I was a huge fan of our next guest. Kind of nervous too. Very nervous.
Big name.
So, representing Ireland in the 92 and 96 Olympics. He's also the team bronze at the 93 and 95 European Championships. Team coach of the Belgian eventing team at the 2011 European Eventing Championships and the 2012 London Olympics. He's also an FEI judge. He's got a lot going on. He's also an author. He's wrote a couple books, but he's here today to promote his new book, The Sport Horse Problem Solver. Welcome to the show, Eric Smiley.
Karen, Robbie, thank you both very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be with you.
Oh, yeah, we are super excited. I mean, like I said, I've always been a fan of yours, so I'm a little nervous, like I said.
Just a little bit of a resume behind you, too. So,
yeah. Oh, but yeah, thank you so much for joining me, us.
Yeah. So, you know, Erica, where are you coming to us from right now?
Sue and I left Ireland about sort of 10 years ago, and we live where Sue comes from, down in the west country of South England. So it's a place called Dorset, and we've lived here, as I say, for about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
What's the weather like over there? It's kind of been like up and down here in Maryland.
Well, it certainly has here. We've had some awful weather over most of England over this last sort of week. It's okay with us. It's misty. It's just the sort of afternoon you're happy to sit inside and talk to some.
Yeah. Now, being in England with the whole coronation of King Charles coming up, are you around any of that, or, you know, are you seeing anything happening with that happening?
Yeah. Yes, that's badminton horse trials weekend. So, yes, that's a clash of that thing. I have an official course walk to do at badminton, and I've interest in a number of competitors. One of them, one of your American competitors, Ariel Grau, because I know her very well. I've taught her a lot, and I've taught her mentor Annie Eldridge. And so I have a lot of close connections with that American rider. So it'll be great to see her back at badminton as she was last year. And it's great to see her back again this year.
Yeah, that's exciting. Also, oh, wow, I didn't even realize that badminton was going on that weekend as well, because we also have the Kentucky Derby.
Oh, yeah, that's a busy weekend.
Very busy weekend.
There you go. Lots to watch.
Awesome. Now, you know, Eric, we always like to try to get everyone's backstory and everything. Can you tell us how you got started in riding, and then, you know, later into eventing, and then obviously into your very large resume of, you know, international competition?
My father had an interest in horses. He was a thoracic surgeon, but he also had an interest in horses as a hobby. So he introduced the whole family to horses through the Pony Club, and I was the only one that took it seriously and did horses more than seriously as a hobby. And then I, through school, joined the army. So I spent 10 years in the British Army and always had the inkling of doing horses professionally at some stage. So at the age of 27, I decided to do horses professionally. And eventing was the logical choice because it's a complete sport. It combines all three disciplines, really, that I had an interest in. So 27, 28, I started to do it professionally. And from then on, it was a case of, I wonder, could I? And I started to be able to. And then I sort of thought, I wonder, could I get to Olympics or whatever? And so you sort of set yourself targets and you try and achieve those targets. Some work, some don't work. So that was my sort of introduction to horses. Pony clubs start off with, and then into eventing later in my 20s.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. What rank were you in the army?
I left as a captain.
Oh, wow.
And I had great fun in the army because I was in a cavalry regiment, which allowed me to have horses as a hobby. And I hunted, I played a bit of polo, I raced a little bit. So I was able to do a variety of equestrian sports, which kept my interest and gave me lots of experience.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now, also, you passed your British Horse Society Fellowship exam. And from what I'm reading, that's the highest teaching qualification in the industry. Exactly what is the British Horse Society Fellowship, and what did you have to do to pass the exam?
Well, there's the British Horse Society is one of the unique societies throughout the world that has a structure to its coach education. And it starts off at the lowest level of assistant instructor, then intermediate instructor, then full instructor. And then eventually there is an opportunity for some people to go and do the fellowship. And to do the fellowship, you have to A, have a CV, which is impressive to start off with. You have to have quite a good background in all sorts of aspects of the equestrian world. You also have to have been a part of the equestrian world for quite a while. They like to see people who have become actively involved in coaching, in running something within the equestrian world, and being a go-to person for people who want advice and guidance. And if you get nominated to go and sit the exam, then the exam lasts about 3 days and 10 hours a day. And you get tested on coaching all levels, all sorts of pupils in each of the disciplines. You get assessed in running meetings, you get assessed in taking open discussions on subjects. You get assessed on rules and regulations, on lunging, on interaction about where the sport's going. It's a very comprehensive exam. And there are some 56 only qualified people in the world who have the fellowship.
Wow.
I feel quite privileged to be one.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Wow, that's
awesome.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
That's really cool. And then you're also an FEI judge. At what point did you go for that, and how long have you been doing that?
Well, while I was competing and coaching at the same time, it just seemed quite an obvious thing to become a judge and to sort of try and put a bit back into the system of what I'd learned. So I was quite happy to become a judge. And I went through all the various sort of tests to become an FEI judge. So I competed at the same time as judging, which was really, I felt complimentary because at least I knew what the competitors were going through. and they could actually look to me knowing that I was also a competitor. So they were being judged and supervised and helped by someone who knew the inside of the sport. So I was a judge the whole way through my competitive life. And I ended up judging at 5-star, judging at badminton and Burley. So I was one of the sort of the senior judges for a while. And then it sort of, you know, you get to an age and a stage that they ease in the younger ones. And so I stopped judging a number of years ago. I think that's fine. You have to keep your wits about you. You have to be young, quick, and on the button. Not that I think I'm not, but I think it's good that the younger judges take over. So I enjoyed my judging. Equally, when I got to coach a national team, that's also time to step back from judging because there is a contradiction in what you're doing. And there might be deemed a sort of contradiction to what you do. So I felt to be impartial when I took over the national team of Belgium in 2011 that I should stop judging then as well.
Yeah. Wow. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's nice to be able to kind of have that both insight of, you know, as a rider, knowing kind of what judges are looking for. Then, you know, as a judge, you know, if a rider's going through something, they know that you know kind of what you're looking at and what they're going through. So that makes a lot of sense to be able to pair that both together.
Well, I think it does, Robbie. I think I would like to think that the riders would be able to come to the judges with a problem, something they're not happy about, and at least I would be able to understand where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And then let me see, I had something else here. And then so you already have two other books out, which are.
Yeah.
I know one is like they call it the cross country Bible, which is like the look, no hands.
Yeah, I was commissioned by the Pony Club in UK to write a book on simple cross country for the Pony Club, and so that was my first introduction to writing, and it was really fun to do, and it has become. It's become quite a popular book because it's a go-to book for the simplicity of trying to make people enjoy and understand how cross-country riding happens. And it was the start of my trying to put things down on paper. So that was the first book, The Pony Club. And then The Two Brains, One Aim came along much, much later when I felt I had a lot written down that I'd done at various stages as I was at airports traveling or sitting in trains or thinking at the end of a clinic, I would write something. And so I had lots and lots of subjects written down. And I looked at it and thought, do you know, I think maybe there could be a book in that. So The Two Brains came along and that was Trafalgar Square Publishing again. They were good enough to publish it, and they were really good. Martha Cook and Rebecca Didier were really great in supporting me in that. So then when I came to them with another idea, the latest one, they sort of said, yep, this is good. We know Eric. We'll sort of see if we can make this happen as well. So, yeah, three books. My teachers at school all those 100 years ago would never have thought that.
I do have one question, though, about the look, no hands. The cover.
Yep.
The picture on the cover, that's pretty impressive. Like, you're going, dropping into the water, no hands. So where was that at?
That was at an event in southern Germany, and it was a bounce going into the water and I missed and the horse put in a short stride. So I had the feeling that I might be coming off. So I was getting ready for that. But actually, three pages into the book, I explain the outcome of it. And it was about the training of the horse the horse actually, although he put in a short stride, picked himself up, landed in, and said, I got this. And I stayed on board and without any problem. But the Look No Hands and the front covers of each of the books, to me, are very important. If I want to get anyone to go and look at a book, then they've got to have something interesting on the cover. If you can't get anyone to go and look at a cover, you'll never get them to buy the book. If you can get them to look at a cover and then to pick the book up and then to flick through it and then to find something interesting, then they'll buy the book. It's the same with going purchasing a horse. If the horse doesn't look at you and prick his ears and say, hello, how are you? I'm pleased to meet you. Then you'll never buy the horse. If it's at the back of the stall, you'll never go and get a, he has to say something. So it's exactly the same with a book cover. And I hope the latest book has that sort of cover as well.
Yes. Yeah. So let's talk about that. The Sport Horse Problem Solver. So what inspired you to write this one?
Well, everyone writes books about what should happen. Experts are sort of wonderful about being experts. And I might take a shot at reading something out of page 10 for a second. It's very, very, very short, but bear with me. When the public listens to experts talk, there is an air of respect that pervades. We admire the confidence, the lofty language, the grasp of the topic so eloquently explained. But underneath, there is another thought that is far too embarrassing for most people to admit. They haven't understood a single word. Now, often experts write things and you become comfortable being an expert. It's written in a language. But no one ever writes what happens when it doesn't work. What happens when everything that I bought or I'm buying into and I understand, but the horse looks at you and says, so explain it to me. And I clinic an awful lot and have clinics for the last sort of 30 odd years. No one ever comes to a clinic and says, things are working really well. I think this is fine. Everyone comes to a clinic saying, I have a problem with this, or this. Can you help me? So to me, it just seemed logical to write a book about what happens when it doesn't work, the problem solver. So I try really hard to think about how that book might be interesting for people. And actually, it ended up being very similar to how I would do a clinic. That was the start of it, Karen.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, like just like we don't want to give away too much. We want people to go ahead and purchase this. I mean, I absolutely love it. Now, one thing that really caught my eye was beware too much inside leg to outside rein. You see a lot of that. And
you go to any show and that's, you know, you hear that echoed out through, you know, the dressage warm up just over and over again by coaches and, you know, any lesson and stuff.
But again, you know, again, there's always too much of it.
I spend my entire life trying to simplify the issues. If you talk about subjects that are, and this isn't meant to sound patronizing at all. If you talk about subjects that are beyond the level of the rider, then you lose the rider. If you talk about subjects that the rider is physically not able to do at that stage in their riding, you lose the rider. If you talk about subjects that the rider is not able to explain to the horse because the horse doesn't understand it, you lose horse and rider. My whole thought process is trying really hard to bring simplicity and logic into what people are taught. It seems illogical to the amateur rider to talk about straightness and talk about evenness between both reins and both hands when you then say to them, ride the inside leg to outside hand, because that doesn't make sense, nor does it make sense to the horse, because all the horse then ends up doing is being squidged to the outside, and then you start wondering why they're not going straight. our thought process has to be following simple words like forwards, straight, and regular. Really simple qualities. Forward is the horse taking you. Straight is the horse on the line you're trying to ride. Regular is keeping the pace as regular and as even as you possibly can, whether that's walk, trot, canter, or gallop. If you're able to do that, you're actually fulfilling pretty much every requirement that you want to do to go and do a dressage test, ride around the jumps, or go cross country. And I'm against complications. And to me, the overuse of these sound bites confuses and complicates the average rider. And remember, there are about 98% of average riders in the world, because it's only 2% or 2 to 5% are the top competitors. Let them understand that. Let them think about it. Because it's a very subtle nuance, which is too early to teach, and it's overtaught and not understood.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And also, you also talk about the word collection. And, you know, looking at different dressage tests over the years between either Mayan or Robbie's, or we have another son, Joe, who he competes, and it's always need more collection, need more collection. And you talk about how you don't like the actual word collection. And, you know, and I like what you say, like, you know, you need a little bit more push from behind, you know, like you kind of like simplify it for everyone.
The word collection, when it was brought in by the FEI at three-star level, which is intermediate type level dressage, with the thought process that it would be important to introduce that level of rider to a degree of collection in their work so as they would be better prepared for the four-star, five-star stuff. That sounds good, but actually the word collection has spoiled dressage more than any other single word in the entire thought of riding. Because if you don't have an availability of energy, and that's the understanding of what the horse's hind legs do, if you don't have an availability, and availability means the horse understands what you're talking about, then all collection does is shorten the neck and slow the pace. So you end up actually not improving anything. It's purely and simply to the detriment of the quality of the pace in the first place. So the word collection is so misunderstood and so misridden, or so badly ridden, that it's one of those things that I avoid the word like the plague. There are many other ways of trying to encourage riders to have a degree of activity from the hind legs, to encourage the horse to be quicker and lighter to the legs, to encourage the horse to have an expression in their paces, to encourage the horse to have an elasticity to the length of step and to the shortness of step. All those words conjure up tangible riding, practical riding sort of qualities, which the rider can feel. Well, they're all part of an end of collection. But don't mention the word.
Right.
For sure. And, you know, like one of the things that I, you know, as I was flipping through the book that I, you know, really kind of clinged on to was your little section on like the trainer's dilemma. And it very much kind of seemed like a lot of taking the small victories as they come, as long as you're moving in the right direction to kind of get to the end goal. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, like I teach a couple, you know, beginner type lessons, very low level type stuff. But, you know, a lot of times it's kind of, we just want to at least get a small win. As long as we're moving in the right direction, you know, it's not going to be something that we're going to fix in, you know, our 1 hour a week lesson that we do have, but over the course of a month or 3 months, over the course of a year. And, you know, like one of my students, I think, is now finally starting to get that over the long time that she's had her horse. Each month is getting a little bit better, but just bit by bit, things are finally starting to kind of click. And, you know, that whole section, you know, really kind of resonated with me of kind of with how I've been trying to approach it, them and our lessons.
Good. I think that's right, Robbie. I think one of the things we all try to do is bite off too much and end up having indigestion. I think you need to have realistic, achievable goals, and they can be small and simple. But if you have lots of them and you keep winning them and you keep achieving them, you achieve quite a bit over a period of time. There is always a dilemma, the trainer's dilemma, in what you do with horses. Because, for example, you have a young horse, you need brakes and steering. So you need the horse to understand the bit. And so you teach this young horse what the bit means. But actually, if the truth be known, the young horse is too young to understand what that means. So we now have a dilemma. Do we teach him brakes and steering, or do we wait till it's time to teach him brakes and steering later on? But you can't do that, because you have to have brakes and steering if you want to ride him. So you teach him something that you know you're going to correct later on. It might be possible to correct it, but equally it might not be. So you've created a problem for yourself. So the trainer is always having the dilemma. How much do you teach at any time? Does the horse understand it? Does the pupil understand it? Do both understand it? If the answer is maybe, then you're not going to get very far. But if you do it very simply and in small chunks, everyone will understand it and move forward. Consolidate, move forward. Try another bit. Consolidate, move forward. And as long as you have an idea where that roadmap takes you, then you'll end up at your destination.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
very cool.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Everyone's got to get this book, because so many good little tidbits. Now, there's also a chapter about rider issues. And, you know, what really got to me was like talking about balance and how there's all different types of body shapes. And you have these little cartoon figures. You got like the William Fox Pitt looking guy who's like tall, skinny, and then you have like your average size guy, and then you got a little girl, I guess. I guess she's a little girl. And just like how important like the different body types is in our sport, and just like how important the balance is and what you need to do to correct your position by your body type.
If I was to ask you what all top sports people have in common, what would you say?
Oh.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Okay. You could. I ask that question and I get lots of answers. They have determination, money, they have ability, they have talent. They're just, and actually, no, all top sports people have in common, they make their sport look easy.
True.
Now, one of the reasons they make it look easy is because whether you're playing major league football, whether you're playing golf, whether you're playing tennis, whatever sport you're doing, the top guys are in balance. Balance is the key to becoming body efficient. And if we spent more time trying to organize our riders into a balance so as they can find where they're comfortable in the saddle, they would be much more efficient at riding. But coaches don't do that. Coaches tend to position riders into what is preconceived as being the correct position. But that might not be suitable to their body type. So you end up devaluing their efficiency by trying to put them into a position. You get dressage saddles that position you. They're a nightmare. And people make lots of money out of selling nice saddles. But actually what they should be doing is selling saddles that allows you to find a good balance. If you can find a good balance, then you'll be able to communicate. If you can communicate, your horse goes better. So for me, rider balance is the key to becoming a much better rider long-term. You hear people talk about such and such a rider has good hands. Well, you don't have good hands unless you have good balance. If you have good balance, your hands then become a means of communication. If you have bad balance, your hands become a means of staying on. So balance is key and critical to every part of riding. The better balance, the better you can communicate, the better the horse is going to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, just to kind of play off of that about like the different body types and balance, in your opinion, how important would it be for a rider to find a coach that has a similar body type and can like actually help, you know, if you have that lanky, tall kid, you know, do they want to go to, the Michael Young, who's a little shorter, or maybe want to go to like the William Fox Pitt, who has like the same body type? Do you think that's important?
No, I don't think it makes any difference. I think you go to a coach that has empathy with good riding and an understanding of what good riding is, regardless of body type of the coach.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Awesome. And just to kind of, you know, see a little bit of the differences between a little bit of riding then and now. So obviously training has been very different, you know, both horses and riders from like the 80s and the 90s compared to now. What do you think is kind of the difference between the training philosophies of then versus now? And what do you think kind of horses or riders were better with back in the 80s and 90s compared to now? I know that was kind of a whole lot there.
Yeah, there's a whole lot there, but I'm not sure that I agree with you anyway. In that I'm not convinced that good training then and now is any different. I think one of the things that now tends to be is now tends to be more arena based, whereas then there was much more opportunity and much more need and thought process to ride in fields, to ride outside, to mix the training on grass and surface, not to do it all arena training. Arena training is bad for the horse's feet, it's bad for the horse's physique, it's bad for the horse's ability to go cross country. Arena training confines people too much, and that's also bad. I think one of the things in the education system is such that wherever it happens to be in the world, people are too programmed and people are too taught. You have to try and learn things yourself if you want to achieve. And by learning things yourself, you question what you're doing. You question, is this right? Is this wrong? Could this be better? What am I supposed to be producing? So I think then and now, there was a much more thought process of puzzling things out and thinking for yourself, as opposed to now, where people want to be taught. People want to be trained. People want to get an answer to their questions, as opposed to finding the answer themselves. Education of young people today has taken away a degree of curiosity. And you need to be curious in the horse world, because every horse is different. Every situation is different. So what's the horse telling me? What message should I be picking up from them? And I think we were much better at doing that 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago than we are now. And that's something that I think we really need to recover, that ability to just explore the horse, to let the horse sort of tell us things and to understand that they are trying to tell us things. So again, I think there are parts in the book when I talk about we need to watch horses, we need to look at horses, we need to look at facial expressions of horses. Early on in the book, I put those four faces of horses, because horses will look at us and they'll tell us what they're thinking. If we miss those signs, then we miss an opportunity to communicate with the horse. And that could be a vital training moment. And it's a pity if we miss those, because that's the key to finding and solving problems with horses.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, wow, that was really, that was a better answer than my question. So thank you for that.
Yeah, that was awesome. Oh, goodness. All right, so we are going to play quick fire questions, Eric. And quick fire questions is brought to you by Turtleneck. Keep your horse dry with the rain turtle by going to turtleneck.biz. So quick fire questions, what we're going to do is we're just going to ask you three questions. Yeah. And we always tell our guests, you don't have to be quick, but we do have strict grading at the end. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Who was your favorite rider growing up?
I'm not going very quick here. my favorite rider growing up. I think I probably admired some of the Irish riders, the Tommy Wade, Tommy Brennan, those some of the Irish riders through the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s.
Okay. All right.
Not a quick answer. Sorry.
No. Definitely. No, that's awesome. I have to look Tommy Brennan up. Yeah.
No, actually I will fire this in. Oh. My favorite stylish rider was Kathy Kusner.
Oh, I've heard of her. Okay. All right.
On a horse called Untouchable. And if you look that up, you'll see that Kathy Kusner, I think, is still alive, living in California.
Oh, okay.
You have to look her up.
Yeah, definitely going to look her up. I've heard the name. So, yeah. All right. Next question. Favorite event to compete at?
Badminton.
Mm, yeah.
That's a quick on.
Now, have you ever come over here to compete at like the Kentucky Five Star?
No, it never had the opportunity. I never had enough horses to do the badminton, the burleys, and team competitions at the same time, being able to sort of go over to the States. So no, never got the opportunity. Oh. except for Atlanta Olympics.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I think I take Atlanta Olympics over Kentucky any day.
I think so.
All right. So last question. If you could ride any horse, past, present, or fiction, who would it be?
Huh. Do you know, I would love to have, in my own sport, I think probably a horse called Merely a Monarch. And that is going back a time. And in just to ride any horse, any I would love to have ridden the show jumping horse, Milton.
Oh.
Because I think he just would have been an absolute joy to have sat on and to feel what a horse that jumps those enormous show jumping fences with ease. So I think probably those two horses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Milton, definitely.
Yeah, that was a very cool horse.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, what do you think?
A++. That was awesome. Yeah. The
crowd's going wild. Awesome. Oh, good job.
Yeah. Now, kind of going back a little bit to the book, you know, obviously don't want to spoil anything too much in the book, but I mean, what would be kind of the one big kind of takeaway in the book that you would kind of give to anyone else that, you know, would be kind of interested in the book? Like, what is kind of like the one big takeaway that you think?
Well, I try really hard to make sure that the language is simple language in the book and when I teach. And the language must be relatable to something that's practical, and preferably something that is tangible to riding. For example, if I say straightness is the horse's hind legs following the forehand, following the head on any line you choose to ride. Well, that seems pretty logical. That if you are, we're tested in all our riding with the management of pace and the management of line. That's all we're tested on. And if you think about it, to do a dressage test, to go trail riding, to do a round of show jumps, that's the deal. So if that's the case, then everyone needs to know how to put the car between the white line and the edge of the road. Otherwise, it becomes chaos. So why don't we put the horse on the line we ride? That seems sense. And that also seems sense that you put your horse between the right aids and the left aids. So you ride the horse evenly on both sides, and the horse goes on the line. So language becomes the one most straightforward means of communication that a coach has with the rider, that the rider has with the horse. Comes back to language.
Yeah.
I mean, that just makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. Oh, goodness. We could probably be here forever asking you so many questions. Oh, my gosh. So awesome. So, you know, the book is awesome. And also, there's a lot of top riders that are loving the book as well. You know, just seeing Tim Price, Pippa Fennell, Sir Mark Todd. You mentioned Ariel Graud. She mentioned the book. And also, the late Jimmy Walford. And he actually, I love what he had to say about the book. He said, when you combine a canny, intuitive Irish horseman with classical training methods, you get a book that deserves a place on every horse lover's bookshelf. And I think that sums it up. Like, I think this book is
Jimmy
awesome.
Jimmy was a great guy and one of the true sort of thinkers of the horse world. I was 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it is, I asked Jimmy to come over and be the guest speaker at the International Eventing Forum, which is something that I've been involved with for about sort of 16 years. And Jimmy gave a very, very, very good address to the 500 or so delegates. And I've known Jimmy for years as a competitor, as a coach, and seen him at lots and lots of competitions. We became good friends. And I have a huge admiration for his knowledge and understanding. And he's one of those guys that'll be sadly missed.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. And then, Eric, one last question. Where can our listeners find your book?
Well, thank you. Yes, I would like them to find the book. Trafalgar Square Publishing are the main publishers. They're the distributors as well. So I would ask people to go to them.
Awesome. Yeah. And you mentioned Trafalgar Square. I'd like to thank Martha Cook. She's the one who reached out to us, said we need to get you on. And she sent us a copy of the book, and, you know, definitely want to thank her. This book, everyone needs to go out and get this book because it's amazing. You know, Eric, we love having you as a guest, and thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been great.
Thank you both very much for inviting me. Thank Martha and Rebecca Didier, the two of them. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope your listeners do as well. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's show. To learn more about Major League Eventing, go to MajorLeagueEventing.com and join our mailing list to get all the Major League Eventing updates. Cheers!